Over the last decade or so, scientists and others have been sounding the alarm about declining honeybee populations, and answers haven't always been easy to come by.
What we do know is that the honeybee is crucial to human survival, playing a critical role in agriculture and much more. So much so that a world without bees is not really one we want to live in.
Our next guest, a beekeeper herself, wanted to learn more about what might be behind the plight of honeybees and what can be done to help them. In a new book, she shares what she learned and introduces readers to some of the people working hard to reverse course on the decline and what they're doing to make life better for bees.
Heather Swan joins us in studio now. She's a lecturer at UW-Madison, where she teaches environmental literature and writing. She's also, as we said, a beekeeper. Her new book is called Where Honeybees Thrive, Stories from the Field. Heather, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Early on in your book, you write that the disappearance of the honeybee is what you call a message to the world. Can you tell us why?
I feel like the disappearance of the honeybee and all of the pollinators that are currently in such distress is really a message to us all, because if the honeybee is disappearing, we will have problems with, you know, food sources, with many pollinators in decline, we will lose certain plant populations. And if they're being poisoned or, you know, becoming extinct, then there are clearly other creatures that are at risk. And I would argue, including ourselves.
Well, Einstein has a famous quote about what would be lost if we lose bees.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thing that you mentioned. That I think that there's some controversy as to whether he actually said that or not, but it's certainly very, very legendary. And I believe that the message is quite clear, that without bees, without honeybees and many other kinds of bees, we would have a really difficult time eating the way that we are comfortable eating now. So many of the things that we eat that we don't even really connect with honeybees are pollinated by, and I want to include other kinds of bees, but certainly, you know, fruit and coffee and chocolate and all of these things that we love. And I think that a lot of people would also add that without clover and other sources, you know, it would be harder to have dairy. So I think it would be really sad. It would be a sad world without all of those things.
And in your book, you clearly have a personal connection to bees. You are a beekeeper yourself. You start your book with your morning walk to the hive, checking in on the hive, seeing what's going on there. Can you talk a little bit about that connection that you have personally with bees?
Well, it's interesting because as a little girl, I lived in an area on some land with my parents for a while, and before I made any human friends, I spent a lot of time with my dog and just wandering around in this meadow and these prairies near where we lived. And what was interesting was just how I didn't think of them as what I would now, I wouldn't use the word sentient as a child, right? But I had a sense that all of these creatures were magical and important and living their complicated lives. And and so I think that as I got older, and then I had this amazing experience of going with my father to a honey harvest. One of his friends was a beekeeper, and being in a room with all of that honeycomb opening up and all of the honey pouring and the scent of that space was incredibly magical and really had a huge impact on me. And then as I got older, I became interested in spending time learning more and spending time with you know, beekeepers, different ones, because every beekeeper, it's funny, there's sort of a saying that I've heard that if you ask 10 beekeepers about something about bees, you'll get 11 different answers. So it's important for me to spend time with you know, different beekeepers and get different ideas from them. But then, yeah, eventually I got my own hives, and that was really special. My relationship, I think, with the honeybee is it's one that is different maybe in some ways than somebody who is keeping bees, like someone who's in pollination services is really interested in the bee as a tool, as a part of our agricultural system. And for me, I think it was much more because I was kind of in love with them. I love watching them. I love the smell of a hive. I don't take very much honey out of my hives. I'm much more interested.
You leave it for the bees?
I do, actually. I take a little, but very little. It's a relationship that's based on love. And the sad thing was that as I was learning these things and spending more time with beekeepers, I realized that the beekeepers and the honeybees themselves were, and many bees, were experiencing this decline. And so I became really curious about that. And first I just started becoming inundated with all of the information about, you know, these unbelievable, you know, massive deaths of bees.
You're talking about colony collapse disorder.
That was part of it. Yes, exactly. And so early on, I became really concerned. Eventually got really sad, and I thought, okay, I'd like to work on this. I'd like to work on not only informing people about this, but also finding ways to solve this problem. And so the idea behind the book was really to find strategies in all different kinds of areas. I mean, the thing about the book is that it wasn't just beekeepers that I was talking to. It was, you know, farmers, as you know, because you've seen the book, artists, scientists who are working specifically on ecology, on insects themselves. And so, but my idea was I wanted to find people who were doing things to make the situation better, because I needed that story.
We're talking to Heather Swan right now. She's a UW-Madison lecturer and author of the book we're talking about right now. It's called Where Honeybees Thrive. We're talking about the ongoing decline of honeybees and what's being done to try to save them. And Heather, you were talking about wanting to reach out to those people who are trying to help after some of the declines we've been seeing in this colony collapse disorder. Who did you find on that journey?
Well, one of the first people I spent time with was a beekeeper that people in the Wisconsin area may know, who named Eugene Waller. And he was the person who sort of explained to me that beekeeping had really changed. And it had changed in part because our agricultural systems had changed. One of the things that I learned from Eugene was that because the landscapes were changing, our bees were, you know, in trouble. Interestingly, from there, I actually went to where I thought the sort of most dire situation was, and that was a place in China, which had become famous for these images of people who were hand-pollinating fruit trees with different instruments. Sometimes they were using feathers, sometimes they were using Q-tips. They had different methods of hand pollinating.
And that would be a world without bees, I guess. You're looking at how do we pollinate if we don't have the pollinators?
Right. And I can tell you that humans are not as efficient.
I can't say I'm terribly surprised.
But the really neat thing was I went to China looking for this sort of apocalyptic future. And while there is certainly an area where they're doing this, what happened was I met all kinds of beekeepers who had bees who were flourishing, and they explained to me that they just simply didn't take their bees into these areas that would be problematic for a honeybee. This was interesting to me because it was a decision that the beekeepers made about how to keep their bees healthy. From there, I just kept moving through my own questions. I spent a lot of time with an entomologist named Sainath Suryanarayanan, and his work was fascinating to me as well because he, like me, was interested in why they were disappearing. But he also had an interesting path himself.
He used to do experiments on pollinators that gave him nightmares.
Yes. When he was in the lab, In his early work, he was asked to actually take a little glass pipette and stab the bellies of these wasps that he was studying. And the work with those insects was so intimate for him that that experience really led him to believe this sort of shocking I'm using scare quotes around that, shocking thought that maybe the insects had feelings, maybe they had, they were suffering. And through that, through that experiment and the discovery for himself that he couldn't continue to make that separation, I think that different people have different ideas about experimentation. Different scientists have different perspectives on it. For him, it was important to move into a place where he was not killing as many insects simply for science. If it wasn't really, maybe they weren't finding the things that he wanted to find.
And so what's he doing now?
So what he did is he shifted his work into thinking more about the ecology around a honeybee hive. And so one of the things that he was doing in one other time in his life was doing he was doing tests on pesticides, which were based on this idea of dosing the bees until they would die. So and what they would do is they had something called an LD50, which meant that the lethal dose of something was 50% of the population would die. So what he would be doing was just pouring pesticides, you know, onto these creatures until they, you know, they were sicker and sicker and sicker, and then they would eventually. And his realization was really that the bees were getting sick at much lower doses than that, and that this sort of experimental design wasn't working for what we needed to learn. So he changed and started thinking much more broadly, and did a lot of work on how particularly neonicotinoids can affect a bee at a much lower dose.
These are these chemicals that we think is behind at least part of the problem of colony collapse disorder, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit as we talk right now to Heather Swan, a UW-Madison lecturer and author of the new book, Where Honeybees Thrive. We're talking about the decline of honeybees and also who's out there trying to help them, what's happening.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your comments. Do you have this connection to bees, maybe as a beekeeper yourself? Do you rely on them as a farmer? Do you have questions about colony collapse disorder and the people who are working to solve the problem, turn things around? Are you one of those people? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with beekeeper and author Heather Swan. Her new book is called Where Honeybees Thrive, Stories from the Field.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think honeybees can teach us about the world around us? Do you think we're doing enough to help bees? Are you a beekeeper yourself? Do you have questions for our guest about her work, her research, and the people she met along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Heather, we were talking earlier about colony collapse disorder, what's behind it, and some of the chemicals that scientists are now strongly believing are behind some of the problems that bees are facing. One class of these are neonicotinoids, and you say there are others too, but tell us what we know about how chemicals affect the health of bees.
Well, I will say that the problem with honeybee and pollinator decline is it's certainly multifaceted. So in addition to other things that they're facing, like viruses and lack of habitat and other concerns, they do have some evidence that says it's quite strong that the honeybees, when they're taking just a little bit of these chemicals into their bodies, it's weakening their, it's affecting their neurological system. So the things that bees do very well are navigation through spaces. They depend very much on their sense of scent, and they're also very, if you think about a honeybee dancing through a hive, mm-hmm. it's so important that they are able to have really exceptional nervous systems, because they're reading when another bee is dancing, where that bee is telling them to go. There's just there, and so the thing is that what's happening is that they're getting this, not just the neonics, but a cocktail of pesticides, and every time they leave the hive. It's disturbing how many are being affected by it. There have been recent tests that indicate that something like 75% of the bees are affected by these chemicals. So it's alarming.
You mentioned the importance of the sense of smell for bees. This is something I didn't know, that bees have this incredible sense of smell, way, way better refined than a dog, even when I think of dogs as having great sniffers. Tell us about that.
It's so interesting what people are doing with honeybees because of this sort of this exceptional ability that they have. One kind of remarkable example of this is bees that are used to detect bombs or drugs, chemicals. And what they do is they put the honeybees in this little thing that looks like a dustbuster, and the bees are in a little harness that looks a lot like the stalks, and so their head is kind of clamped down. And I'm using my hands, and no one in the,
on the
list,
yeah.
No one can hear me. But they are sort of strapped into these little machines, and then what happens is there's a tiny camera that that films them while they are introduced to a certain smell, and they've been trained with a reward to identify a certain smell. And so if you take this little dustbuster and suck some air into the chamber, if the bees respond in a certain way, they will know with an amazing amount of certainty that there is or is not the chemical that they're looking for in that.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Let's take a caller now. We've got Art joining us in Milwaukee. Art, hi.
Hello, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Art.
I'm a small beekeeper in the Milwaukee area. Just Milwaukee. I've only got two hives, but I've got friends that have got hives. We're having a terrible problem with trying to have the hives survive over wintertime.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's anything been looked into as to if there's any kind of a supplement we can feed the bees this time of the year to make them stronger, to see if they can survive, to help them to survive.
Boy, that's such a great question. And I think that, as I said, I think there are a lot of beekeepers that feel they have different solutions to these problems. One of the things is that I'm not sure how much honey you're leaving on your hives, but it would be, you know, important to leave certainly enough honey for them to get through the winter. I know that there are different ideas about also keeping them dry in our climate, especially, so some people wrap their hives. In terms of supplementing, this would be a great question to ask somebody that is in your area specifically. And again, I feel like one of the things that I've learned for myself is that a lot of beekeepers try a lot of different things because your particular area, your very local ecosystem will be slightly different than someone that's even, you know, as close as I am. And, you know, if you think about somebody who's in Vermont or Florida or anywhere else, they'll have a different set of variables. But one of the things that I would think right away is just to continue to make sure that they do have enough honey stores for the winter. And that's one thing that could really help them. And then to keep them dry is another thing that I recommend.
Well, thank you, Arden. I hope that helps. Good luck to you and your bees. And Heather, as we go forward, what can people who don't keep bees, what can they do to support pollinators and the health of pollinators?
I think this is one of the things that I'm most interested in is how we can support honeybees and other pollinators, birds, all kinds of creatures, with our everyday habits. And one of the things that is really would be really easy for us to do is to think differently about lawns, I think. And I know that this is a very controversial subject because people love their lawns in America. And so what I have been suggesting to people is to plant more, to less grass and more flowering plants, plants that will be especially native plants that will be food for these pollinators, it's really important that they have a variety of things to eat so that they are getting good nutrition. And I think that one of the shocking things is just really how much land we use in the United States for lawns. And we think about the fact that we're not only using that space for grass, which is really not helpful to any creature, but it's also where we use a lot of chemicals. And so I think that if we thought differently maybe about what a beautiful lawn was, if we opened up to a new idea that maybe not the whole lawn would be grass. What if part of your lawn was meadow or prairie, and you had a different idea about what beauty was? And I think that what's interesting is a lot of people talk about their neighbors being, you know, upset if they don't keep their lawn at a certain height and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is, I think that's very true. And I think it's really about changing the way that we think about what a healthy landscape looks like. And if we want to have honeybees, I think we really need to make some of those choices.
Heather, thanks a lot for coming up and talking today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Heather Swan. She's a lecturer at UW-Madison, where she teaches environmental literature and writing, and she's also a beekeeper. Her new book is called Where Honeybees Thrive, Stories from the Field. And for those in the Madison area, you can hear more from Heather during a book launch event. It's going to be held at A Room of One's Own bookstore on Friday, November 17th at 6 p.m. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.